Okay, I see it's 9 o'clock, so I want to start. Let me begin by, as I often do, responding to some comments and telling you a few things. First, if you recall, 2 weeks ago, I quoted that text from the Mishnah Brura that seems to imply that scholars are allowed to, they don't have to pay attention to the repetition of Shmoneh Esrei. They can learn, they can do other things. And I thought it was a bit surprising. That's why I shared it with you. One of the people who listens to the classes, not live, but he listens to it afterwards, is Rabbi Yonasan Rossman. He's from Staten Island. He's a young guy, but he's written already a couple of sfarim in Hebrew. So a big Talmud Chacham. He emailed me, and I did not know this, and I thank him that the Rush, Rav Asher ben Yechiel from Toledo. In fact, I'm very happy he sent this to me because on the trip this summer to Spain, I have to speak a lot about Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, so I'm going to mention this as well. If you look in the Archos Chaim of the Rush, Rav Asher ben Yechiel, number 14, he says explicitly that he begins by saying you can't talk during davening and you can't talk during the repetition of Shmoneh Esrei. Ela im kein bedivrei Torah or bedivar mitzvah. Ola hachzir shalom. Or someone says hello to you, you could say hello to him. Or if you're involved in a mitzvah. Or he says that you could talk during Shmoneh Esrei in matters of learning. So I'm assuming he doesn't mean talk if you're disturbing everyone else. But if you go to the corner and you talk to someone, in other words, you are putter, you're exempt from listening to the repetition of Shmoneh Esrei. And obviously, if you can talk to someone else, you can certainly read a sefer. So I did not know this, and I thank Rabbi Rossman for that. Let me tell you something else before we start. Two more things. Israelites, if Yisrael is with us already, I don't see Yisrael Keshkin. I'll wait till he gets on. Because I want, this relates to something he asked me, something very interesting. If not, I'll say for next week. I was last Shabbos, not 2 days ago, the Shabbos before that, I was at a shul in Philadelphia. I can't even remember the name of the shul now. And the rabbi's name is Aaron Felder, Rabbi Aaron Felder. For those who are listening from Toronto, you probably will know the name because his father was the leading rabbi in Toronto for many years, Gedalia Felder. He's also a big student of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He was like 10 years together with Rav Moshe, not just studying in the yeshiva, but he was his assistant. He would come to his house in the evening, his home every night. He's published two volumes of stuff he heard from Rav Moshe, and he had a very close relationship during those years he was there. He also is, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so, the only rabbi in a modern Orthodox shul in America or Canada, maybe the world, well, I don't include Israel here, the only rabbi of modern Orthodox shul in America, Canada, England, I think, who has written responsa, volumes of Shevot Teshuvot. In fact, he gave me, and I'm going to share something with you in a minute, two of his volumes, here they are, you can see they're, Shelas Aaron, the last volume was published in 2009, and the previous volume in 2000. The talks I gave, because I use these talks I give here, people like to hear them. I spoke on Rav Avad Yosef once, I spoke on Rav Cook, and I spoke on Rav Gorin. And he told me something interesting about Rav Gorin and Rav Moshe Feinstein that I think it should be put on the public record so people know about it. I think I even wrote something down here. I remember it. Interestingly also, for his drusha on Shabbos, he didn't give a drusha. He responded to one of my posts, the last post on the Sforum blog, about Art Scroll censorship, and he told the whole story about when he first learned about the censorship in Rav Zevin's Hamoedim HaHacha. He's friendly, or he was friendly with, I don't know if he still is, with Rabbi Meir Zlotowitz, the editor of Art Scroll, because Zlotowitz also went to MTJ, Rav Moshe Feinstein's yeshiva, and he confronted him. He told the story to the show. He went through in great detail and told him it's a disgrace what he did and that there's no one has the right to take anyone else's words and change them. And that was his Shabbos morning drasha. But I gave my talk on Rav Gorin. And Rabbi Felder is very interesting because, first of all, he's a real posek. And everyone calls him with the questions in Philadelphia. I have a big yeshiva in Philadelphia, but the Rosh Yeshiva are not really practical halachic people. He's also the halachic consultant for the Chaf Kei. He makes all the decisions for the Chaf Kei. And, oh, he told me interesting things about, I asked him how come the Chaf Kei won't give hashkacha to things that have corn syrup in it. And not the idea that we just spoke about already with Ritzel Chonon, that syrups are not considered kitnios, but the idea that it's batel berov, it's nullified in the majority. And he said to me he would tell any of his congregants that they can eat things with corn syrup, but the people, that is, the masses, don't want it. And therefore, the Chaf Kei can't give hashkacha to anything that has corn syrup, even if it's batel, and, you know, the taste, you can't taste specifically the corn syrup, because the people today don't want it. They want chumra. That's what he told me. Okay, so I gave the talk on Rav, it was like a back and forth. After I spoke, he would respond. And he was in Israel for many years in yeshivas, and he made a point of meeting all the rabbanim. He's one of the only people to have smicha from Rav Zevin, and that's a whole story of how he got smicha from Rav Zevin. But he told me that when he was Rav Moshe's secretary, during the whole dispute over Rav Goren, he didn't just tell me. He got up and he gave his response to at Shel HaShudas. He responded to my talk, which was given at lunchtime, and he spoke a lot about the issue, and he gave what he thought was Rav Goren's big problem, that Rav Goren was a general, and therefore he didn't feel he had to consult. He wanted to give orders, and everyone had to listen. And then he told the following story, which took place in 73, I guess, 74, that Rabbi Dolgin, Simon Dolgin, who was a big rabbi in Los Angeles, Mizrahi, had gone to Israel and had become, I don't know what his position was, something, Jewish agency or something like that, and he came back to America to speak to Rav Moshe to try to convince Rav Moshe Feinstein not to oppose Rabbi Goren. And this is the story he told. Rabbi Dolgin came to the house, they engaged in some small talk, and then when Rav Dolgin tried to bring up the issue of Rav Goren and that Rav Moshe shouldn't come out against him, Rav Moshe said to him, "I'm done talking, it's now time for you to leave." And Rav Moshe stood up and he basically pushed him out the door. He said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to talk to you anymore about this. I don't want to have any conversations about this issue with Rabbi Goren. I want you out, I want you to leave right now." And Rabbi Felder was shocked. I mean, he's been with Rav Moshe all these years. He's never seen Rav Moshe speak disrespectfully like this to anyone. He's never seen him throw anyone out of his house. He's always had conversations, even if people disagreed with him. So as soon as Rabbi Dolgin was out the door, Rav Moshe said to him that, "I'm sure you're wondering why I just did what I did. It's not normal for me to do this." And he said that the reason he did it is because if he just would have sat and had a conversation with Rabbi Dolgin about, the pros and cons, the issue, the next day in the newspaper, there would be a report that Rav Moshe Feinstein is not so opposed to Rav Goren's decision, or that he sees room for compromise, or anything like that. And he said, the only way I could make sure that a false report did not show up in the newspaper was to shut down the conversation and to tell him that it's time for him to leave in my house. Then Rabbi Felder said, the big problem was Rav Goren. Rav Goren should have come to America, because maybe he could have convinced Rav Moshe that he was correct in his approach. And we dealt with Rav Goren, we dealt with Rav Moshe, so I thought you'd find it interesting. Yes, I know Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky has several svarim. I don't want to get into any details, but let's just put it this way, that Rabbi Felder... I leave it at that, that Rav Felder, at least the sense I got, is that he's the real postseik of Philadelphia. I don't want to say any more about... I do know that when it comes to Gittin, everyone, including Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, calls him. He in his Sefer, this is also something I want to share with you. He has two tshuvot here. If you recall, we spoke about the new minhag. Fairly new minhag. I can't imagine it's more than... Well, I know it's not widespread, more than 100 years old. I think it's even probably less. The idea that women have to listen to Parsha Zohar. Something like that never happened. The first one to say this was Rav Nosson Adler. And then it's mentioned first in print by Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the Binyan Sion. So you're talking about maybe 170 years, 180 years known. And until this became popular, I'm not sure. Maybe it's only the last 60, 70 years. I've never done a study of this. I mean, the other thing that we do when we repeat on Zecher, Zecher, Parsha Zecher, that's only become universal in the Ashkenazic world maybe 50 years ago. Before that, it wasn't. But so then, and we have a new practice now in many shuls, that which I don't recall this when I was young, so maybe this is something only 20 years old or a little more, that the women, because now we've told them they have to hear Parsha Zachar, which, as I already mentioned, is not, no Rishon holds this, no Achron holds this until Rabbi Nassan Adler. We now take out the Sefer Torah again after davening to read Parsha Zachar for the women. Rabbi Felder, in both volumes, volume 1 and volume 2, in volume 1, number 34, he says this is absolutely incorrect. He says it's Karov Liot Bizayon HaTorah. He says he thinks it's close to being a Bizayon HaTorah, and he explains why, that since women are not obligated in this, it's forbidden to take out a Sefer Torah to read especially for women in this. And then in volume 2, he expands on this. Now, in volume 1, he doesn't quote anyone else. He just gives his own reasons, and he doesn't quote Rav Moshe. The problem is, which I have, and I'm going to call him tomorrow about this, I've already called him subsequently to ask him other questions, is that he says that Rav Moshe Feinstein held Pasuk Pasakina Harifata She'asur Lotzi Sefer Torah Lashmiel Anashim. He says Rav Moshe held that it was absolutely forbidden to take out the Sefer Torah for women to hear it, take it out a second time. I don't know, I'm going to ask him if that's the case, how come he didn't mention that in the Volume 1? He just remembered it now in Volume 2. There's something a bit strange about that. But then he goes further and says, I asked Rabbi Elyashiv Shlita, and Rabbi Elyashiv said that this is forbidden to take out the Sefer Torah. So I don't know if any other shuls or any other rabbis or anyone has expressed an objection to it, but here's an example of what we've spoken about in the past, that these minhagim just pick up and sort of take off. And Rabbi Felder is almost like a lone voice here arguing that this is a new custom. Fine, you want to do the custom, women want to come listen, you can do that, but you can't take out a Sefer Torah for no purpose. We know you're not allowed to take out a Sefer Torah for no purpose. And according to him, since we don't paskin like Rav Nassan Adler, therefore taking out the Sefer Torah is without purpose, and you heard me read it, absolutely forbidden. There are many other interesting tshuvot. I don't have time. We have to get onto our own topic. I'll just tell you one thing. He quotes the Meshech Chachma. This is a very, I didn't know this Meshech Chachma because I haven't gone through all the Meshech Chachmas. I, preparing for the classes, I skimmed them, and I missed this one. But if you look in Kisetse, I should know it, it's my Parsha, Bar Mitzvah Parsha, Perachot Beis Pasuk Dalet, he deals with the Pasuk, if you see the donkey of, another Jewish person that, it says, Achicha, your brother, you have to, if it's lost or something, you have to help it out. You can't just forget about it. The problem is, in Parshas Mishpatim, Perachot Gimel, virtually the same Pasuk, it doesn't use the word your brother, it uses the word Oivecha, your enemy. So the Meshech Chachma says, it's the same idea. Help out the lost donkey or the donkey that needs assistance. What are you going to, why in the, before in Mishpatim, it's your enemy, and here it's your brother. What's going on here? And the Meshech Chachma says that we know that you're not supposed to hate your brother. It's a pasuk. You're not supposed to hate the Chicha Bilvavecha. On the other hand, we also know there's other times when you're told if someone's a sinner, you're supposed to hate them. The rabbis tell us this and everything. So he says that it depends on the circumstances. That in Mishpatim, it was before the Egel Hazav, and they were all pure and perfect. They hadn't sinned. And therefore, it's telling you, even a sinner, your brother who's a sinner, you can call him, you refer to him, that way as Oivecha. However, because if you're so holy and he's a sinner, you can have negative feelings for him. But after the Chet HaEgel, when everyone had sinned, then Asor Lishnoish, because then you can't have any hatred. You can't, because you too are a sinner. And he says something incredible, that he says that if anyone who looks at their actions will see that they're also not perfect. They also have problems. And therefore, it's forbidden for someone like that, except if you're a super great person who's a tzaddik tamim drachav, if you're a perfect person who's never sinned, well, then you could feel terrible feelings to someone. But everyone else who is a normal person and sins, for such a person, asur lishno ish kazeh. You can hate, and therefore everyone has to be your brother. Even the person who sins has to be your brother, and you can't say no, because he's a sinner, he's not my brother anymore. I mean, it reminds me almost of what Jesus said, that, the one who, if you don't have a sin, you cast the first stone. And I said already, when we did the Ben Amozah classes, all the good stuff from Jesus comes from our sources. But here you have an incredible thing that, since we're all sinners, basically, you really can't have this hatred against someone else. And Rabbi Felder quotes that. Okay, let us move on. Continue with Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky. I have some other things I want to do, but I'll save them for next week. Let us pick up. If you recall, last class we ended, and I said that Rabbi Abramsky was just like Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, he was just like Rav Zevin and others, writing for the Hebrew periodicals. There was a whole Orthodox Hebrew periodical, and this was for Hebrew writers in the Orthodox world. These were not the greatest rabbis who focused on Talmud and things like that. And if you look at people like Weinberg and Rav Zevin and Rabbi Abramsky, they were great Hebrew stylists, precisely because they were engaged in the debate, and they were really redeeming the language from the Maskilim to show that the Orthodox could also write well. And then I said that he became Rav, but this is where we ended, in 1914, of the city of Smolevich, which is next to Minsk, and he took the place of the Kovno Rav, Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro. Now, Rabbi, I don't know if anyone remembers Rabbi Rav Henkin classes, but Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky's successor was Rav Henkin, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. In fact, according to the hagiography, the community requested that Rav Yecheskel Abramsky pick the rabbi for them. It's a little strange thing, but according to the story, we're told that he met with... I want to tape myself in case there's a problem with the tape. They've asked me to tape, so I'm taping as well now. Okay, they asked Rav Henkin to meet, Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, and he met with 26 different candidates, and his recommendation was Rav Henkin. I didn't see that in Rav Henkin's biography, but this is in Rav Yecheskel Abramsky's biography. Now, after World War I breaks out, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, he goes to Minsk. And that's not far from Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky's town, an hour by train. And for 3 years, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky spent a good deal of time. Every week he'd go for a few days, spending hours with him, with Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. And really, there are many stories that came out of that. In the Rav Zevin classes, I quoted you the famous story where I don't want to go through it again now, but where people came in, they weren't sure who to bury first, and Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik gave an answer, that there's nothing in the Rambam, but the fact that it's not in the Rambam, that explained to him the answer. Now, it was during his time in Smolevich that Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky begins work on his Tosefta commentary, his magnum opus. I'll get back to that in a second. But while there, during, in Smolevich, another important change happens. Of course, that's the Russian Revolution. After the war, many Jews are now in Lithuania, they're in Latvia, they're in Poland. They're out of the reach of the new Soviet Union. However, there was millions of Jews who were behind, now wasn't known as the Iron Curtain, but behind the Iron Curtain and under communist rule. And it was especially the Jewish communists, as we've spoken about in previous classes, who were a real problem for them, as we will soon see. And we spoke a good deal about this with Rav Zevin. We'll come back to this in a little bit, not too much, in a few minutes. But I want to now talk a bit about his Tosefta commentary. I'll put up on the screen here what it looks like. The first thing to note is that Rabbi Yechezkel Avramsky devotes himself to the Tosefta. That becomes his life work for the rest of his life, his major task. Why? It's not like the Tosefta is intensively studied in yeshivas. It's not like the Tosefta is studied at all. I think I can say, without exaggeration, that in all my time in yeshiva, not once did we ever study the Tosefta. I was always curious. I used to open up the back and look at it, but I never heard it referred to. I never heard it. I just never did it. I know that in Gush, there are makorot sometimes to the Tosefta, to Lieberman's commentary, but traditionally, you don't study the Tosefta. Well, Rabbi Yechezkel Avramsky, in the introduction to his Tosefta commentary, to Brachos, he mentions that the first person to seriously examine the Tosefta, for those who don't know, is a Tanaitic work of Jewish law. It's like a parallel to the Mishnah. Many things are the same as the Mishnah, other things are different, but it's a work of the Tanaim, of, you know, the first great sages of the Talmudic period. He notes that, and we don't have commentaries or anything from medieval times, he notes that the first person to critically examine the Tosefta is the Vilna Gaon, the Gra. And the Vilna Gaon corrected many errors that had crept in. He also mentions, what we know, that the Tosefta never became popular, no one really studied it. The only people, he says, who studied it are, quote, Yechidei Sgula, the elites. They studied it. Those people, and what makes them special, they are people who are careful not to omit any aspect of Torah study. When you think of it for a minute, it is a little bit strange that Tosefta isn't studied. Here we have volumes, a huge work, written by in the Mishnaic period. You have Rabbi Akiva and all these great figures, and it's totally ignored. You would think that instead of people, let's say, studying more recent works, 20th century writers, why would they do that if they haven't yet finished Tanaitic works? There would be great excitement if tomorrow we discovered, like we did with the Dead Sea Scrolls, new scrolls dating from Tanaitic times, and we have new writings. You know, everyone would get all of the Tanaim, everyone would get all excited. We have new passages from Rabbi Tarfon, from Rabbi Shmuel, etc., etc. Everyone would be going crazy and with great excitement. And yet, why should they get excited? We have a work called the Tosefta, which has all these new texts. I say new because no one studies them. And if people are so excited to see a new, new writings of the Tanaim, they don't need to wait for something to be discovered in the desert of Israel. They can, pick up the Tosefta and they can learn all sorts of new things. They can learn Yerushalmi. I mean, in other words, we have plenty of texts that aren't devoted to by people that we don't need anything new. Rabbi Yechezkel, he laments the fact that in today's day and age, even the special people, the elites, the Yechidei Sgula, most of them don't even study the Tosefta. And he says that what this shows is that people feel that in order to be a complete Torah scholar, you don't need to study the Tosefta. And he thinks that that's a complete distortion, because, again, like I just said, how can you be a complete Torah scholar if you leave out study of a huge repository of texts from the Mishnaic period? I mean, what could be more important than writings of the Tanaim? So that's what he says. You know, what would be more precious than that? Now, there's a reason why people don't study it. I think the reason's obvious, because it doesn't have much halachic implications. We don't use it for practical halacha, but when you think about it, I mean, most of our learning in yeshivas has nothing to do with halacha. It's Torah Lishma. And therefore, why don't we study it? We should study it. It's vital to understanding Torah, and I'll give you an example in a minute where I think you'll agree. He's also talking about more, though, because he says, Rabbi Yechezkel Avramsky says, it's not just Torah Lishma, which in and of itself should be enough to convince people to study it. He says that in years past, the Tosefta was used for practical halachic matters as well. For example, if the Talmud is not clear, or if the Talmud doesn't discuss something, the Tosefta would be used for a halachic decision. After all, it's just, you know, if the Mishnah doesn't tell you, and there's nothing in the Talmud, then the Tosefta tells you something, that should be halacha l'maisa. Same thing about Yerushalmi. And many people think the same thing with Zohar as well. He says, however, that Torah scholars today look at it as an old book that belongs in an archive. And he thinks that's a problem. And he also says there's the problem of the text, that the text is corrupt, there's all sorts of errors, and one of Rabbi Yechezkel's goals is to correct the text so that we have a clear text. Now, I mentioned that there are some examples of halakha, and if you look at the Tshuvot literature, you'll see they do cite Tosefta when they think that it can be important for halakha. Let me give you an example of something which, as far as I know, is the most famous example of halakha being cited as appearing in the Tosefta. I don't know if it was famous 30 years ago, but I've heard, if I'm not mistaken, Rav Schechter quotes this. I believe he's adamant about this. And there's definitely other posting because I've seen it quoted over and over again in halakha. Let me read you what it says in the Tosefta. This is Tractate Shabbat, Perek Zion, Halakha Aleph. It's talking about what is forbidden because of Darchei Amori, because we're following the ways of the Gentiles. And it gives a few things, and then it says, Chut Adom Aletz Va'o, that you cannot wrap a red string on your finger. You can't wrap a red string. I'm holding, I don't even see, Rabbi Yechezkel doesn't even have a comment on this in his commentary. But already we see that, not just about, a little less than 2,000 years ago, this was regarded as Darchei Amori, as a practice, you know, not just something the non-Jews did, but something which is forbidden as a form of idolatry, connected to idolatry, Darchei Amori, a red ribbon. I've seen this often quoted, this Tosefta. As I said, it's quoted in practical halakha more than any other example from the Tosefta, because this passage does not appear in the Talmud. Doesn't appear in the Yerushalmi. It appears in the Tosefta, and many rabbis have written in both English and Hebrew traditional tshuvot as well as articles about the fad of the red ribbons, and I've seen people with these red ribbons, and the argument has been made that this isn't just stupid, but this is actually a halakhic violation. I mean, putting the key in the, Rav Schechter thinks putting the key in the challah, I'm not sure when you do it, he thinks that that's actually also Darchei Amori, because it goes back to an old Christian practice, as opposed to just being foolish. But and we know about many different segulas and things like this, but the Tosefta says it's actually forbidden. I looked in Lieberman. I'm holding right now the Tosefta Kipshuta. And he explains that this segula of using the red ribbon was very popular in the ancient world. And he refers to sources. He tells us that the red ribbon, shani, what color is that? That's not really red. That's, what do we say? We say that's crimson. Someone can write in, hutashani, what color is that? Someone will write it in for me. I don't think it's red. More crimson or something. Anyone writing in? I don't see. Hold on a second. I'll because that's in ancient society that Lieberman tells us that was scarlet or crimson. I guess that's red. Same thing. Although when I think of crimson, I went to Harvard, so when we graduate, we wear crimson, and crimson is not exactly red. It's sort of red, but it's not bright red. It's maroonish sort of. Lieberman tells us that this was, in ancient times, this was a kamea. This was like it's sort of like an amulet for children. That is, you would wrap it around children. And then he says, and this is what I'm mentioning to you. Lieberman tells us, I remember, he's talking about when he's a youth in Lithuania, that they used to tie around children's necks in my town. He came from the town of Motol. He says they would tie around the children's neck when there was a scarlet fever as a protection, as a segula, as a good luck charm to keep away the scarlet fever. He said, Lieberman tells us that they would tie this red ribbon around their neck. V'lo michu bi'adam. Then the rabbis did not protest. No one protested when the women would tie the strings, it could be the men too, tie the strings around their neck. And then he says, and this is also the practice in Poland. So now we have a problem. The Tosefta says this is forbidden, and he's saying that they did it, and the rabbis in protest. And this is, so Lieberman gives an explanation that, which is sort of a limud schus, I guess, for today, a justification. He says, "Ukanireh she'ein lano el mash asru chachamim v'lo amru el betzbo." Lieberman says, perhaps, or he's assuming that it's only forbidden to tie it on your finger. However, if you want to tie it on your neck, mutar. If you want to tie it, or at least the rabbis thought that it was only an issue. Part of the idolatry was to tie it around your, you know, your finger. But if you tied it around your neck or somewhere else, that wouldn't be forbidden. The only reason Lieberman is saying this, you wouldn't assume this otherwise, is because he's saying that in my town, the rabbis didn't protest. It could be the rabbis didn't know about the Tosefta, or it could be that the rabbis thought that, the Tosefta means red ribbon, it means any type of red ribbon, but we don't hold to the Tosefta, since it hasn't been quoted in other sources. It's hard to say. Let's see, we have a long comment here, I'm not going to read it, that from Rodney about, the Shlissel Challah. It is true that there is this one Hasidic source from the 19th century that supports it. Now, I don't think there's any question, if you read the text, the sources, that this Shlissel Challah business is comes from non-Jewish sources and is it's a pagan ritual. But I don't know, if we're going to start banning all pagan practices, we'd have to get rid of all these various segulot and everything, because almost all of them come, even the ones that appear in medieval Jewish sources, they come from Germanic folklore and other things. So, ein l'davar sof, as they say, unless you just want to get rid of all the segulot. But all these various segulot that you hear about, I think without exception, they come from original non-Jewish practices that the Jews adopted. So what is, returning back to the Tosefta, what does Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky say? That my goal is to restore the way they used to be. He says it should be every, quote, Talmudi, that is, every Talmudist, should study Tosefta, and it should have a place in the curriculum. And that's his goal, and as he spent his whole life on this multi-volume commentary of Chazon Yechezkel. I have to say that I think he was singularly unsuccessful. I don't think Tosefta, his Chazon Yechezkel, maybe made a tiny dent in studying it, but people do not study it. However, Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky is correct, that those who study the Tosefta will have their eyes open to all sorts of matters. For example, he notes in the introduction that you have disputes in the Talmud between Amoraim, and yet if you look in the Tosefta, you see the same disputes, but here the two protagonists are Tanaim. What this shows us is that this is a Tanaitic dispute. It's only recorded, and you can speculate as to why it's only recorded in the name of Amoraim in the Talmud, but this is not an Amoraic dispute. This is a Talmud. This is a Tanaitic dispute, and that will have various implications. There are also opinions, just general, forget disputes, opinions quoted in the Talmud in the name of an Amora, and in Tosefta they appear in the name of Tana. So this obviously is of historical importance, but it also could have halachic importance as well, because if you thought originally that it was only an Amora, then you saw a Tana elsewhere disagrees with it. Now that you know a Tana also holds that opinion, that could have halachic implication. Now take a look at the Tosefta on the page here I gave you. You see, it has two things. First, it has like a Rashi and Tosfos here, where I put the pen, the green mark. That's like the Rashi, his explanation. And then the Beurim over here is the Chidushim, sorry, that's, more in detail, analytic issues that are raised that are not just a simple explanation of the text. I get more like a Tosfot, trying to tell you something more in depth. And over here he has the, different versions of it in the Chidushim, where he'll discuss the different versions. And he completed the entire Tosefta. In terms of Pshat, for those sections of the Tosefta that Lieberman has his volume, his volume here is one of them, Tosefta Kipshuta. First of all, you have the Tosefta he published, and then his commentary. I'm going to write something down here for myself because I want to show you next class. for those volumes that you have Lieberman, really, I mean, you could, the Beilurim of Rabbi Abramsky are really superfluous. You don't need him. You just, if you just want to know Pshat, Lieberman is the best thing to look at. However, his Chidushim, those are, of course, valuable. And Lieberman mentions Abramsky, that his stuff is valuable. Not to mention the fact that there are many, many... Lieberman never finished. He finished maybe a third of the Talmud, his Tosefta Kipshuta, Tosefta, his commentary. So Rabbi Chesko Abramsky, all these other tractates you have, his is the commentary. With the Beurim and the Chidushim, anyone who wants to look at Tosefta, you have to take a look at Rabbi Chesko Abramsky, especially on all those tractates that don't have the Tosefta Kipshuta. His connection to this work was such that when he died, before he died, he put in his will that at his funeral, his Tosefta, his Chazon Yecheskel, should be carried behind his coffin. It's reported that the Chasam Sofer had also had his manuscripts, because in the Chasam Sofer's lifetime, nothing had been published, that the manuscripts were carried behind his coffin. But Rabbi Yecheskel, so perhaps Rabbi Yecheskel did it because of that, together with his coffin, carry the manuscripts, none of the manuscripts, carry the volumes of the Chazon Yecheskel, and he also said that in heaven he will be a Melitz Yosher, he will be an intercessor for those who study his work. The first volume appears in 1925. And remember where he is. He's still behind the Iron Curtain here in 1925. How was that able to be published? Well, there was a woman who was leaving. In those days, you could still leave. If you can get a visa to get into another country, you were still permitted to leave the Soviet Union. And there was a woman, she happened to be a niece of Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz of Kamenetz. She was leaving, and he gave her the manuscript, she comes out, and 3 years later, the volume appears. How'd you get across the border? By 1925, by then, it might have even been illegal. In the early years, it was legal, but I think by 25, it was illegal. By the end of the 20s, it certainly was illegal, but the borders are very porous. You could hire guides, and the guides would take you through. It wasn't hard to get through. If you were caught, it was big trouble, but it wasn't that hard to get through. We have plenty of examples of people who got through. Now, in 1925, he was no longer serving at the city I mentioned. He had moved on to a new city, Smolevitz. He was no longer there. He now had moved on to Slutsk, which is near Ein Beit Yisrael. It's a very important city. We know it as Rav Mr. Zalman Meltzer's city. This was the Ritbaz's city, Yaakov David Wolofsky. This was the city, and this was in Belarusia. The previous rabbi, Rav Mr. Zalman Meltzer, had left shortly before, and when it was still possible to get out. And Rav Mr. Zalman Meltzer, and Rav Yecheskel Abramsky is Rav in Slutsk for 7 years. Since I mentioned Slutsk, let me just... those who read the Svarim blog will see this later in the week when it appears, but I'll just say it now. I'm going to be writing about this book, which by Eliyahu Stern on the Vilna Gaon, which there's real serious problems about this book. It has interesting things and all, but there's some serious problems, and there's errors of the sort that, unfortunately, I feel bad that someone who knew the topic didn't read it over, because some of the errors really affect his thesis. You know, the idea that the Vilna Gaon is a modern type of person and not opposed to philosophy. I mean, some of the errors, as you'll see, really do affect it. But other errors really are just errors, and they could be corrected without any real problem. One of these errors is, it says in the book here, that the Vilna Gaon was born in Slutsk. And he provides the source for that. And I was shocked when I saw that, because whoever heard of the Vilna Gaon being born in Slutsk? And if you look at the source that he cites, it doesn't say Slutsk at all. It has another city with a beginning with the letter S. So the Vilna Gaon was not born in Slutsk. In fact, if you open up Encyclopedia Judaica, it'll tell you where the Vilna Gaon is born. Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky is rabbi there from 1923, but he wants to get out. I assume he wanted to get out immediately, if he could. But by 1925, we have proof he wanted to get out. And this, again, raises the issue we've spoken about so often. what, you know, is the job of a rabbi supposed to leave? Is he supposed to stay with his people? I mean, if he leaves, who's going to be, you know, the teachers of Torah? We know what the Lubavitcher Rebbe taught, that he told his followers to remain there, and all the other rabbis and rebbes said to get out. Rabbi Yechezkel Bronsky wants to get out. And we have a letter from 1925 from him to Rav Kook, chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, asking him to get a certificate so that he will enter Eretz Yisrael. And he writes to Rav Kook, that why does he have to leave? If you remember when I told you why Rav Moshe Feinstein said he had to leave? Because he couldn't give his children, his son, David Feinstein, I don't know if the others were born, there, he couldn't give, he knew he couldn't instruct him in Torah there. And Rav Yechezkel Abramsky says he cannot raise his children in the Soviet Union. His oldest son was 13, and his next oldest son was 11. And he says to Rav Kook he cannot keep them in the house all day. Apparently, up till now, he had pretty much been keeping them in the house. And he's afraid, you know, he can't control the kids. He can't keep them in the house all day. And if they associate with their peers, which they basically hadn't done till then, they're going to be led off the Torah path. So for the sake of his children, they have to leave the Soviet Union. He even is ready to send the children out of the country without him, since he worried of what would happen to them if they remained in communist Russia. But he was not given permission to leave. The Soviets didn't give him permission to leave, even though he would get permission from the British government. That is, he got a certificate to come to Israel, Eretz Yisrael, Palestine. He was not given permission to leave. And in response to his continued requests, he was even put in prison for a short time in 1927. Now, while in the Soviet Union, you still had Jewish life. That's, I mean, people were not all thinking that, you know, there's nothing there. You still have some Jewish life. And while there, and Rav Moshe Feinstein was there at this time, and he discusses things as well. While there, he puts out two issues of a Torah periodical. Here's the title page. It's called Yagil Torah. It says they're edited by Yechezkel Abramsky, Rabbi of Slutsk. This is 1927. The end of 27, because it says in the Hebrew, day, well, it's Tishrei, September of 1927, and two issues appeared. These were the only Torah periodicals ever to appear in the Soviet Union. This is issue one, and there's also issue two. The title, Yagdil Torah, it's because there was a Torah journal published earlier in the century by two rabbis, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer and Rav Moshe Binyamin Tomashev in Russia. Then, so Yechezkel Abramsky sees this as this was the Torah journal, Yagdil Torah, of the Lithuanian rabbis. So he sees this as a recreation of that. The Moshe Binyamin Tomashev, who's known as the Mabit, he comes to America. He lived in Brownsville, if I'm not mistaken, was a rabbi there, and he reissues it. You can see this all on HebrewBooks.org. He published for a number of years. After he comes to America, beginning 1914, 15, something like that, the Yagdil Torah. And it's important because it's the only Torah periodical in the United States, or one of two, during that time. There was another one called HaMitzvah, and they're both on HebrewBooks.org. In fact, I made the copies for one of the big libraries of HaMitzvah, and I sent it into HebrewBooks.org. They represented two different groups. Yagdil Torah was the Agudas Rabbanim faction, and then there was something called the Degel Rabbanim, and they fought each other, or Rosh Kachas and everything, but for the most part, that's the distinction. I dropped my paper again. This Mabit, Moshe Binyamin Tomashev, his grandson is Gerald Blitzstein, professor at Ben-Gurion University. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says that Gerald Blitzstein is the greatest student Rav Soloveitchik ever had. He's the winner of the Pras Yisrael. I think if you ask Jerry Blitzstein, he would say that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is the greatest student, but Blitzstein is a great, great scholar, a great Talmud Chacham and everything, and he's been at Ben-Gurion probably since around 1970, you know, an early person who went on Aliyah. Well, this is an unbelievable thing to publish a Torah journal in the Soviet Union. They got permission from the government, but it can't be easy, and especially traditional Jews in the Soviet Union don't want to call attention to themselves. You had people. You had people throughout the Soviet years of the Soviet Union who went to shul. And when I say the Soviet Union, I'm really referring to Russia. Because those, you know, the Bukharan Jews and the Jews who lived in these other places far from Moscow and St. Petersburg, they for the most part weren't bothered. and you had still had real Jewish life. I mean, you could speak to the people who emigrated, you know, in the last 20 years. And then, you know, they tell you that they weren't disturbed and that it wasn't a problem. However, in not in those territories, but in actual Russia, if you associated with religion, you couldn't get a good job, your children wouldn't be allowed into the university. There's all sorts of reasons not to be public about your involvement. And there were, you know, private minyanim and things like this. So to publish a Torah journal, you're calling attention to yourself. Although, you know, they were able to do this. And, I mean, Rav Zevin, we spoke about it. I mean, he made the case that in the Soviet Union, the Constitution permitted freedom of religion. So technically, you know, Judaism was allowed, and all these things were permitted. Soviet Union didn't always follow this constitution, but they published this Torah journal. The second issue was edited, and you can see this also on HebrewBooks.org, by Rabbi Zevin, and together it was, you know, Rav Abramsky assisted him, and as I said, these were published, both of them were published in government printing houses, because you didn't have private printing. Once the Soviets took over, everything that was published had to be done through government printing houses. In the second issue, by the way, there is an article by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and there's another article by a man named Petachia Menken. I don't know if anyone recognizes that name, Petachia Menken, but he had a very significant son, because you know, he left shortly after that, Menken and his son changed his name from Menken to Neria. His son is the great Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria, who was a very important figure early on in Bnei Akiva and Kfar Aroa, and very important for religious Zionism in the State of Israel. He comes to Israel, Eretz Israel, and becomes a student of Rav Kook and Rav Neria. In the years after Rav Kook's death, from 1935 to 1970, Rav Neria was a one-man publishing house writing about Rav Kook, and he really, before Rav Kook was so popular, and before Rav Kook was so influential, Rav Neria was spreading the word about Rav Kook, and as I said, he was in Kfar Aroa. So his father was this Rabbi Petachia Menken, who was a rabbi in the Soviet Union. Mel tells us that Jerry Blitzstein retired from mandatory retirement at age 68. For male academics, I don't know. Well, female academics, they don't need to retire. They can go stay on longer. If so, that's discrimination. Menachem Kellner also had to retire I don't know what the rules are. I mean, why one university or other? But there's also mandatory retirement in Haifa. I don't know if that's a government rule or a university rule. The reason I say this is because even though he retired from Haifa, he then started a new job. And that is at the new Shalem College. Kellner, I don't know exactly what his position is. He's not just a professor. He's some dean or something. He's involved. He's a macher there. And precisely because he had to retire in Haifa, so now he's in Shalem. So what, Shalem doesn't have to follow the rules, I guess. I don't know the situation with the unions or anything like that, but I would think those 68, telling people 68 that now you're, you know, dead wood and we have to move you aside for the younger generation. It's a little young. 68, but I guess the world of scholarship can now benefit more from Jerry Blitzstein, or Yaakov Blitzstein as he's known, for what he can write. These journals, as I mentioned, Bell says that women retire at an earlier age. Now, I don't know how that goes on. Women live longer. So if anything, women should retire longer. How there hasn't been a lawsuit to change that. These journals, as I mentioned, were the only Torah journals, and the obvious, not only the last journals to appear, the only Torah journals to appear. Rabbi Zevin and Rabbi Abramsky, who worked on the journals, we know that they were very good friends. And in the classes on Rabbi Zevin, I spoke about their friendship and their close connection. And that, you know, as rabbis in the Soviet Union, there was a lot they had to do. I also mentioned that they had an agreement, and I'll repeat it. And this agreement remained for the rest of their life. They would not speak about chametz. Chet mem sadi. What is chametz? They wouldn't speak about Chabad. Rav Zevin Chabad. Rav Ramsky, definitely not. They wouldn't speak about mem Mizrahi. Rav Zevin Mizrahi. Rav Ramsky Aguda. And they wouldn't speak about sadi, Tzionut, Zionism. So as long as they didn't speak about chametz, they would be fine. And this is famous, the story that, you know, the closest of friends, friends in the Soviet Union, they would go visit each other. Abramsky went and stayed with Rebzeven. I mean, you couldn't even mail letters because people would, you know, the censors would be reading it. So if Abramsky wanted to speak to Rebzeven, he had to actually go, you know, go visit him. So it's famous, though, that they wouldn't speak Lachametz. And you can see this in numerous sources. There is an article, though, in the Hatzofet on the anniversary. It was sent to me by the person who wrote it. His name is Rafael Posen. He's an expert in Targum in Israel, but he used to go to Rabbi Abramsky's Shiurim in Kol Torah. I'll speak about that, the Yeshiva Kol Torah. And I mentioned to him that I was, you know, writing on, going to be teaching about Rabbi Abramsky, and I asked him to send me what he wrote. So he writes that they wouldn't speak, he quotes what we all know, that they wouldn't speak Lachametz, and what he says Chabad is Chet, Tzadi is Sionut, and for Mem, instead of Mizrahi, he says it's Musar, which is completely wrong. Well, I mean, who's supposed to be opposed to Musar? What, Rabbi Abramsky's pro-Musar, and Rav Zevin's anti-Musar? Of course not, Rav Zevin's not anti-Musar. Rav Zevin's pro-Musar, Rabbi Abramsky's pro-Musar, so there was never, the Mem doesn't stand for Musar. And I don't know where he got this and why he did, maybe just made it up or something, but no. Chametz, Chabad, Mizrahi, Tzionut. That's what it stands for. Okay, a couple more minutes, and then I'll take comments and questions. So Rabbi Zevin is stuck in the Soviet Union. Not Rabbi Zevin, Rabbi Abramsky, he can't get out. In 1928, he's chosen by the city of Petach Tikva, which is the first city, you know, the original city for New Israel, to succeed. He's chosen as rabbi. The thought was that, although he had a certificate already, the thought was that Rav Kook was able to assist in this, that, you know, as a private citizen, it's one thing, but if he's actually chosen as the rabbi of a city, and, you know, this is a big deal that the Soviet Union will let him out. And that's not the reason they chose him. They didn't choose him just to let, you know, that he could come out. They chose him because they thought he was a great rabbi, as he was, and now that he's chosen, he can come out. But as far as I know, this was never, and everything I've read, they didn't choose him just, I mean, you could see they could do something like that. It could be Pikuach Nefesh, save his life. But that wasn't the reason. Now, he was a great rabbi, and there were people who knew him in Eretz Israel, and they chose him to be the rabbi. He was to succeed a rabbi named Yisrael Citron, who was a big Mizrahi rabbi and a son-in-law of the Rebbetzin, Rav Yosef Rosen, who we will have classes about. This itself is a strange relationship because the Rebbetzin is a big anti-Zionist, or anti-Mizrahi, and his son-in-law is Mizrahi. It got to the point that the Rebbetzin's daughter had to write to her father to tell him not to, you know, write anything else anti-Zionist because it puts us in a difficult situation. But he dies young, Yisrael Citron. Those who read my Weinberg biography, remember this case of a man who died and his wife needed a chalitza, and there were two people who could do it. One was behind the Iron Curtain, and he wasn't at all religious, and one was an actual, convert to Christianity, and he was living in Königsberg. Oh, I discussed it in the book there. This was Yisrael Citron. So this was the Rebbetzin's daughter, Yisrael Citron's two brothers, who, and I discussed the Rebbetzin's dispute there with Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. But he dies, and they appoint and Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, and Rabbi Abramsky assumes that now he's going to be able to leave the Soviet Union. But this too would not happen. The Soviets refused to allow him to leave. And this went on for months, the letters back and forth. Petach Tikva waited about, I think it's even a year and a half, until finally it became obvious that Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky was not going to come out, and therefore they needed a rabbi in the city, and they choose Rabbi Reuven Katz. After we're done with Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, before we move on to the next figure, I just want to spend a class or two on Reuven Katz, because I've mentioned him already a number of times, and I think I'll mention him more. And he's not a major figure, but I think he's worth doing. He was serving at the time a rabbi in Bayonne, New Jersey. I don't know what's left of Jewish life in Bayonne, but 20 years ago even, there was still a kosher restaurant. I think it was called Reitner's. I remember going with my family to this kosher restaurant in Bayonne. I don't know what's left in Bayonne. There's a shul there. Oh, Yisrael. So at the end, you weren't here at the beginning, Yisrael. I want to share something that I relevant to a question you asked last week, but I'll do it next class. So next week, God willing, be on right at the beginning, and I'll share it. But, you know, you say Bayonne, you had big rabbis, Rav Chaim Hirschenson. How many classes do we have on him? He was the rabbi in Hoboken. I found his grave, by the way, online. One of our listeners asked me, do I know where Rav Chaim Hirschenson is buried? And I said, no, I don't know. And I live in New Jersey, so, you know, I love going to cemeteries. And I go in Europe to all the places, but in America I've never done it. And there's a website, Kivarim, kevarim.org or .com, which has, you know, they track down all the graves of rabbis in America, although they didn't have Hirschenson, where the grave is, and they have pictures of it. So he asked me where it was. The internet is an unbelievable thing. Within 5 minutes, it wasn't even 5 minutes, online, I was able to find where Rav Chaim Hirschenson is buried, because there's a website that has all the cemeteries, or the Jewish cemeteries in the country, linked together, and I was able to find out in under 5 minutes where Rav Chaim Hirschenson is buried. So then I emailed the cemetery, and I asked, could I get a picture? And they said, yeah, for a $5 donation, you can get a picture. So they took a picture, and I have the picture. It wasn't such a, the problem was that it wasn't cleaned up. They told me that, you know, the grave, the tombstone needed a little cleaning. So they said for $25, you could do that. And the guy who listens to the classes, Yecheskel, he's not with us now. He listens, doesn't listen live always, Yecheskel Moskowitz. He wanted the mitzvah. He gave the $25. He had a new picture taken, and I don't know if it's up yet on Kavarim. But it's a cemetery in New Jersey, which has many other great rabbis as well. Buried there. So, okay, so Rav Reuven Katz was in America. When we do Rav Reuven Katz, I'll explain to you how he came to America, and he even left one son in America, Abraham Katz, if that name means anything to you. So Rav Yecheskel is stuck. His grave is not in Hoboken. The grave is not far from Hoboken. There's a cemetery in Bergen County there, which has... Yes, and I'll get to Ira's correct. Rav Katz's son, Rav Michal Katz, from YU. I'll deal with this when I don't want to get into it now. I'll deal with it when I deal with Rav Reuven Katz. In the summer of 1930, Rav Yecheskel Abramsky is arrested. You know, some rabbis were sent to Siberia, Rav Shaul Yisraeli's father and others. They were trying to destroy religion. And you had the Jewish communists that in particular were trying to destroy religion. Why certain rabbis were sent to Siberia, others were... You know, Yecheskel Abramsky was in constant correspondence with the outside, so he's thought to be a danger, I guess. He's in the summer of 1930, he's arrested, and he's sentenced to death. If this was any other rabbi, the smaller-time rabbis, they're sentenced to death, no one hears about it, and they're executed. And that happened to rabbis, either they're executed, or others were sent to Siberia, which is the equivalent of executed. However, Yecheskel Abramsky is already a known figure. He's one of the most important rabbis in the Soviet Union. He's distinguished. He was an important rabbi before the Soviet Union. He's not, you know, the Gadol Hador. He's not at the level of the highest level of the top five or six of the greatest, but he's definitely the second level. If you take the next, you know, 10 rabbis, 15 rabbis, he's that level. And if you're looking at rabbis in the Soviet Union, he is the greatest rabbi in the Soviet Union. That is affirmed for Talmudists. If you'd ask people like Chaim Moshe Rozinsky and others, Rav Kook, who is the greatest rabbi in the Soviet Union, it's Rav Yecheskel Abramsky. He already has a reputation now from his book, and he's known as a great Torah figure. So when he is sentenced to death, well, he's lucky that the world, the Jewish world, immediately responds. Just like as we spoke about when Rav Yosef Yitzchak, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, when he was sentenced to death, the world rallied. So too, we spoke about, was he really sentenced to death or not, or was just that was the story? But with Yecheskel, he really was sentenced to death. And we'll begin next class what the world did. There was an international outcry, and the sentence is reduced to 5 years of hard labor in Siberia. But we're going to pick up with this because, you know, because he's such an important person, maybe that's why they decided to execute him, because he was too much trouble. But on the other hand, again, because he's such an important person, that's why people care. And that's why you can make an issue of it. And his life was saved precisely because, you know, he became too big, even for the Soviets to kill. And for all the terrible things that Germany would do, just a couple years after this, we can thank the German government for saving the life of Ryazanov Abramsky, as will be explained next week. It's already 10 o'clock, so let me stop now. And any comments or questions, I'll be happy to take them for a few minutes. What I want to share with you next week, Yisrael, and anyone else, but in particular Yisrael, because we were talking about the wild yeshiva students last week, I want to share with you something from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, the late Rosh Yeshiva of Neir Yisrael, what he says about how all the great Gedolim were all wild men. And that's important. I think that's a good translation. I'll read it to you next week, and you tell me. So that relates to the class, that relates to last week. I'll tell you something else. I spoke in Flatbush last night. It was very nice, and I think one or two of you were there. You have to see this crowd that comes out. 70 people, probably a good 15 of them were Hasidim with long payas and bekeshas. And I was honored to have there Eliezer Katzman, who's probably the greatest expert after Stamfer on the yeshiva world in Lithuania, Rabbi Eliezer Katzman. And I started speaking about, I don't know how I got into it, I started speaking about the issue of the revolt in Tells, because the talk was about how to write history, and I mentioned, since we had just done it last week, it was on my mind, how you know, the hagiography doesn't mention anything about the revolt in Tells, and I said that Rabbi Yosef Kahneman, the famous Rabbi Yosef Kahneman, the Ponavezhe Rosh Yeshiva, was the leader of the rebels. So after the talk, Eliezer Katzman raises his hand and says, he's going to tell me something else, that the other rebel, he later becomes, of course he becomes non-religious, as a lot of these people did, he becomes very involved, active in Israeli government politics, and he was a great assistance later on in building the Ponavezhe Yeshiva, I guess I think he said in getting the land or whatever it was. So this buddy of Rav Yosef Kahneman, who both of them, they shut down the Tel's yeshiva, and they were, you know, so much big troublemakers there. They still were friends many, many years later. And oh, and why did Katzman say this? He wanted to give this an example also because I spoke about Rav Chiyak of Weinberg and Samuel Atlas. That is how you have these certain Gedolim who still have close friendships with people who are no longer in the Orthodox world. And he gave Rabbi Kahneman as another example of this and of the benefits that accrued to Rabbi Kahneman and Ponavezhe because he still remained close to his childhood friend, even though his childhood friend had left and had gone into a complete, had left the Torah world to go into the Zionist world. Okay, let me see comments here. This is not the Khrushchev period, it's the Stalin period, and I don't even think it's pre-Stalin. It's, I mean, we're talking, let's see, let me refresh myself here. Lenin dies in 1924. There's no executions, there's no problem. I mean, this is all Stalinist era. You had, during the Leninist era, you had trouble with the Jewish communists, and you had people go to jail. But you never had any executions, you never had anything. I mean, Stalin went after the Christians also. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I don't see anything. One more. I see someone's writing. Avraham is writing. Maybe it's not writing to me. You know, sometimes if you start typing in something else, it appears that I can see that you're writing. Okay, it looks like I'll wait one more minute for Yisrael. How does his work on the Tosefta differ from that of Lieberman? Well, Yaakov Ellman is a scholarly work. It's not a commentary. Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky is a commentary, both a commentary pshat, simple explanation, as well as a more detailed commentary. Lieberman's is also an explanation of the pshat, the simple meaning, but Lieberman's is, there's no work like that, and it'll never be completed, because there's no one else who could do it. The knowledge in Lieberman's mind was beyond comprehension. All the parallels in the Greek writers, in the Latin writers, in all of rabbinic literature. So it's not just an explanation of the, you know, of what it means, the simple. He's giving you all the history and comparing. But that doesn't take away from Rabbi Abramsky's Kli Yeshiva. Rabbi Abramsky wrote traditional yeshivish type of explanations, which you will not have in Lieberman. Lieberman is writing academic scholarship, and really, if you want to study Tosefta, you should study both of them. And Lieberman quotes, he refers to Abramsky's work as an important work. So anyone who wants to do Tosefta should study Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, not for the simple explanation that you can get in Lieberman, but for his more detailed explanation, yeshivish type explanation, analytic type of explanation, comparing also other passages. Yeah, I guess when you say a simple explanation, you mean on the spot. What do the words mean? What does this mean? And then the Beurim, he explains, contrasted to other passages in the Tosefta, in the Talmud, etc. And then you want to know what academic scholarship says. If you want to know, there's all sorts of words there. Greek words, Latin words, those, what Lieberman explains. If you want to know about the realia, if you want to know, everything about the text, what it's referring to. I mean, if it quotes a jug, Lieberman will tell you all about the way that the Greeks, the Romans used to make their jugs and how this is relevant. It's an unsurpassed work. And that was just like Rabbi Abramsky's magnum opus was his commentary on the Tosefta. Lieberman's magnum opus was his commentary on the Tosefta. What I can say is that Rabbi Abramsky's work can be superseded. There's no question about it. If someone today were to do a traditionalist work on the Tosefta, he could supersede it. He could have better explanations. He could have a more detailed commentary. No one is ever going to supersede. As long as people are studying Tosefta, Lieberman's commentary will be the one. Avram, that's a good question. And this is maybe why Posen thought that Mem stood for Musar, not Mizrahi, because if you think about it, Mizrahi and Zionism are synonyms. So if you're saying Chametz, you have Chabad, and then Mizrahi, and then why do you need then Zionism? Just have Mizrahi. All I can say, Avram, it's not a Tosfos, it's not the Torah where there's no repetition. It's a joke that people used to joke, or they used to joke, that we don't speak about Chametz. And that's what it meant, Mizrahi. It's one thing to be a Zionist, but being a member of Mizrahi, that's also an issue. Because being Mizrahi, you could be a Zionist, you could have strong feelings about Zionism, but not be Mizrahi. When you're Mizrahi, you're part of an organization that in the mind of some people on the right is going against the Torah sages. It's an actual organization that is violating the great Torah sages' views. So being Mizrahi is worse than being a Zionist. Being a Zionist is bad enough, but if you're a member of Mizrahi, you're actually joining an official organization that's involved with the Zion, with the Mizrahi movement. But like I said, it's not a Tosfos that you can ask, but it definitely never meant Musar. And neither Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky nor Rabbi Shlomo Yossi Zevin had any problems with Musar. There's no arguments about Musar. Elman never wrote a commentary on a Tosefta. This is a traditional commentary. Elman has a book, a scholarly book about, it's called Tosefta and Breitot. It's about aspects of the Tosefta. But it's no different than a book on the Talmud or a book on the Mishnah. Dov Zlotnik has a book on the Mishnah. This is a commentary, page after page, giving you explanations on each line in the Tosefta. It's a traditionalist commentary. Yeah, it's not higher criticism, by the way. He's not doing any of that. It's simply a commentary on the Tosefta using modern scholarship. Halivni, when he does his commentaries, this is what we call, higher criticism on the Torah, source criticism. Halivni does source criticism on the Talmud. What year was this text written? Which author? Who authored it? What was the presumptions of this text versus that text? It's very different. According to Halivni, the Amoraim don't understand necessarily everything that the Tanaim are saying, and that we give a different explanation. It's higher criticism. It's source criticism. All Lieberman engages in is textual criticism. And truthfully, there isn't even that much of textual criticism. It is a commentary on the Tosefta using the best information of academic scholarship. Simple as that. The rabbis in the days of the Tosefta lived in a Roman environment. They lived in an environment which was a Roman environment, but the language was Greek. The Greek was the lingua franca of the land of Israel. The Jewish population would have spoken Aramaic, but in general population, they spoke Greek.
And therefore, you need to know about Roman civilization, you need to know about Greek civilization, you need to know about Roman law. If you want to understand the Tosefta properly, you need to. If all you care about is the halacha l'maisa and the practical halacha, then you don't need to know about it. Although Danny Sperber has this essay, you know, the old joke of the Talmudists against the critical scholars was that you tell us what clothes Rashi wore, and we tell you what Rashi said. So Sperber has this article in one of the Orthodox forums in which he shows that sometimes halacha can actually be derived by what people wore, so it's very important. And Lieberman thought the same thing as many halachot, that, you know, when Chaim Soloveitchik taught, he was a Rosh Hashiva for a couple of years, he taught brachos, he taught some other things, he made all the students learn the, when Rashi quotes a French word, he made sure the students knew all the French words. If there was a, like I said, a jug or anything like that, or if you're learning Hilchos Shabbos and he was teaching you and it had a reference to an item. I mean, you learn Hilchos Shabbos sometimes, it describes things in the Talmud, you're not sure what it's referring to. You can't say, Yehuchin Steins also have a picture of it. I guess Artscroll probably will too, or Corin. But before all these pictures, you would want to know what these things looked like. Most people, we would just, in yeshiva, we just would skip these things because, you know, it's the concept. But if you really want to understand what the Tosefta is describing when it describes this certain writing utensil or it describes this jar, you know, can it be used on Shabbos, this and that, you know, Lieberman will tell you all, everything you ever wanted to know about the way they wrote in ancient Palestine. He even has two books, one called Greek and Jewish Palestine, the other called Hellenism and Jewish Palestine. So they're very different types of works. Yisrael says, what about Mizrahi? Do some feel violate Torah views? The fact that the Mizrahi party cooperated with the non-Orthodox, that he cooperated with the Zionists to create a state, and that in and of itself was crossing the line for them. That they were involved in an organization which was majority, the Zionist movement was majority non-Orthodox. And especially, you know, many great rabbis were sympathetic and even involved with Zionism in the Herzl years. But then the Zionist movement took a vote and they agreed that they're also going to have what they call culture. So it wasn't just a movement to get a state. It was also about a movement to revitalize Judaism. And the culture for the secular Zionists is very different than traditional Jewish culture. So many rabbis left the Zionist movement after that. They still believed in a return to the land of Israel, but being Mizrahi means you were involved, you were a member of the Zionist organization. And that, they thought, was a problem. Not to mention the fact that if you believe that Chaim Soloveitchik is, or you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe are the greatest sages, then the Mizrahi is going against them. The way it was that the older rabbis were the more conservative ones. They were Agudists, but many of the younger generation were Mizrahi. And when you came to America, this is something people don't realize. You had Agudist Rabbanim in America. They all were Mizrahi rabbis. These were all old European rabbis. Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, Yeshiva College. They were all Mizrahi rabbis. There wasn't an Agudist among the whole bunch. So in America, the East European rabbis, the old-time rabbis, were all Mizrahi. But in Europe, the leading rabbis, that is, were Aguda rabbis, or non-partisan rabbis, you could say. Yisrael says that he worked on the London Basin for 17 years. Did he speak and write in English? Yes, he spoke and wrote English, and we'll get to his time on the London Basin next class. Not only did he write in English, he used to read the Jewish Chronicle every week. Geniuses like that have no problem with languages. Okay, everyone, I will say goodnight. We'll pick up next class. If there's any other comments that people have, feel free to send them, and I'll begin next class with them. But Yisrael has already given us something to look forward to, because Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky is soon going to end up in London. But we have to explain how he gets there. First of all, where we ended tonight, that he's sentenced to Siberia for 5 years. How does he get out of that? We'll pick up next class.